Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
That first section to me was important for us to just know that all that's out there, and as we went along, we were saying this is a good thing to maybe share, and these are some things that probably will fall flat or would be harmful to share when we're in a caregiving position or a being with, bearing another's burdens, a mourning with others who mourn kind of position. So our goal here and now is to re-say those things when they come up, but mostly just to mine you three and your experiences at bedsides, across from people in counseling, and just to say, what are the best practices? What are the best framings? And how do we, as listeners and those who don't have your training, how can we at least take some strides forward to not make mistakes, or to at least or point us in direction where we can if we're so moved? You know, what are some good books to read, or some good perspectives to explore a little bit? So kind of keep it at educational level as well as just stories and examples as you go along of what works well. So the way we divided up ahead of time was for me to throw it to you, Jason, first. You are basically doing this most of your days right now, being with people in great suffering. Where would you want to start on this best practices?
Well, I have a couple of notes here that I can just kind of go down, and if people want to jump in, please do. But the first thing I wrote down under this question was to set it when confronted with somebody who's suffering, right? To set aside your desire to be comfortable. Because you're not going to, right? And in confronting suffering, you're going to be exposed to vulnerability. You know, your own vulnerabilities might come up. You want to do something. You want to fix the suffering, but you can't, right? You don't know what to say. You don't know what to do. And that can be just incredibly anxiety-provoking. I remember the first time I was truly terrified of suffering. I was in Chicago. I was in grad school, and I was a chaplain resident at a local hospital up there. And I received a call from one of the nursing stations saying that, you know, there was a man who was dying. He was dying of cancer, and could I come up? And so I go into this room, and nobody's in this room. There's no family, right? It's late at night. It's dark, and there's just this withered husk of a human being lying in this bed. Can't speak. Is just breathing really rapidly, really shallowly in and out. It's just, you know, and that's it. And I was terrified, absolutely terrified, and not knowing what to say, not knowing what to do, not having enough experience as a pastoral caregiver to recognize that maybe the best thing to do is just to sit in silence and hold this person's hand. But just being terrified in that moment, right? Because it was uncomfortable. And so I'll admit, I failed. I failed that man. I the first opportunity I had to get out of that room, I left, right? When my shift was over and the new chaplain was coming on, I was so grateful just to get out of that room, because just not knowing what to do in that moment. And so, you know, for me, I think the where my mind goes when it comes to best practice, the first thing I thought about was that story, and just the truth that you need to be able to set aside your desire to be comfortable.
Fantastic. Wow. Others, stories or amplifications from either of you others, other two?
This business of compassion, I mean, my understanding of that word is suffering with, and so it's not going to be comfortable. if you really join people in their suffering, then there's going to be discomfort. And that's just part of what you accept if you're going to step into the people's lives fully and completely.
Yesterday, I was on funeral death notification duty. And here at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the remains of a young lieutenant who was killed just last week in Afghanistan, he and his entire crew by an IED, a roadside bomb. This lieutenant's remains were delivered here to Fort Sill. Both he, his parents, his wife, and her parents are from this area. He wasn't stationed out of Fort Sill, but this is home for them. And as you might imagine, this young widow, mother of a three-year-old and a one-and-a-half-year-old, her world has just changed everything. The genre, the soundtrack, it's a completely different story from here on out. And I had the opportunity to take her aside, and in talking I found out that she herself is a former soldier, and that she and I, interestingly enough, were deployed to the same area kind of back to back, and that gave her kind of an opening to be a little bit more personable with me, and there was a sense of connection. And in the back of my mind, I had to give my full attention to the conversation we were having, but in the back of my mind I thought, what a tender mercy that, you know, all the differences between who I was as an individual and who she was as an individual, we found that one thing in common which allowed me to just be present with her, and we were talking about things that did not involve the body of her dead husband coming in a chartered flight just a distance away. And I juxtapose that to the commanding general's wife, who at the moment that the casket came out of the plane, you know, this young widow's shoulders began to heave up and down, and this regal woman, the commanding general's wife, came right up alongside and held her hand like only a woman could do in a motherly way when that young widow's own mother and mother-in-law were present. And I was so impressed with her ability to be present at that moment without saying anything. So here's a challenge that I continue to discover in being present with people in their suffering. Perhaps the biggest mistakes I've made have come when opening my mouth to say something, whether to rush in and try to fix, or a long list of ill-advised things have come out of my mouth from time to time. And yet, it could be equally disconcerting for someone who is viewed as a representative of God, as Jason was saying earlier. Just, you know, even when the home teachers come to your house, they represent something more than themselves. It's transcendent. And so to simply show up and not say anything and just be a mute, that doesn't work either. And so a very helpful thing to remember is that at the tragic moment of whatever the suffering took place, and now those who are experiencing the after effects, God was present then and is present during the moment. And as I think we've already alluded it, and maybe even just come right out and said it already in the discussion, the anxious need on my part to go in and fix is almost always an indication of my forgetting that God is present with us, that He is Emmanuel, and that the things that I say and share need to incorporate a mindfulness of God's presence, and that He too, in almost every situation, is, I wouldn't want to say as sorrowful, but is beneath, under and over and transcends. There's no part of the person or family suffering that God isn't in solidarity with them.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I like that a lot, you know, and it speaks to the point that suffering needs to be approached with humility, right? And maybe even a sense of privilege, right? That here, that this person, you know, and at least, you know, in our line of work, right, as chaplains and even in the church, though, but that someone who is maybe a relative stranger to you is letting you into their lives when they're at their most vulnerable, when they're at their weakest. I mean, how is approaching them at that moment not a holy thing? And I think it's that sense of God's presence and that sense of awe that Nathan's talking about that helps maybe inform my response when I move from silence to what speech I offer, right? To when it is appropriate for me to open my mouth and to say something. And I think that comes from listening, right? From letting the one who's suffering set the agenda and the tone for the conversation. And that's going to influence whatever verbal offering I have, whether it's words of compassion or whatever it is. But that's always framed or informed by my listening to them. And, you know, if I could just throw out another quote, right? Something Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that is just has stayed with me ever since I first read it. He said, what I'm able to do for another person will be shown to me in prayer. Prayer commends the others into the faithful hands of Christ, and Christ will deal with them. In order to pray correctly, we must be able to listen to the other person. Those who cannot hear another person are no longer able to hear God's word or to pray. Our love for another consists first of all in listening. And I love that, right? That if I'm going to open my mouth, if I'm going to, you know, sometimes people will want me to pray for them. Chaplain, will you please say a prayer? Or chaplain, what do you have to say to us? Or just that moment when I'm not being invited, but I'm feeling prompted as if now is an appropriate time to open my mouth, but that I've done my listening first. And that's what's going to help me then to know how to go from that point, what appropriate encouragement is going to look like, what compassionate speech is going to look like. Not because, you know, I think I know the gospel so well and I've read all the scriptures and I've sat through all the Sunday school lessons, right? But that I've listened to the one who's in pain, and that's going to set the tone for whatever it is that comes out of my mouth.
That story and the comment on listening reminded me of an experience a couple of years ago. I was, as a hospice chaplain, was called to a local hospital, to the ICU. A woman, a young woman in her 40s, was dying. Her family was there, husband and children. And they had asked me to come to pray with the family at her bedside. And what they had decided to do was, she was on a ventilator, and that was the only thing sustaining her life, and she had made the choice that she didn't want to go on that way. So they were actually going to pull the ventilator, and the doctor said she'd probably die in 10 or 15 minutes. So I went in there to pray and had a prayer with the family, and I think this is part of listening. What struck me as odd is I was the closest to her. I went right up to the bedside and held her hand. Every other member of the family had pushed back against the wall, and it was obvious that they were just really afraid. They were uncomfortable, whether it was about her dying or the process or the bruises on her body or whatever it was, they were a bit freaked out. And she looked at me, and all she said was, "Will you stay with me the whole time?" And I said, and I'm thinking in my mind, here's a person asking me to be with them as they transition from life, in this case, I'm going to say death. I thought, what an honor to be asked to do that. And so I sat right down next to her, grabbed her hand in one hand, and then I had my other hand on her arm. And when she looked at me, it was just so clear that she realized that her family was doing the best they could, but they just were so afraid, so freaked out, they could not be any closer than they were. At the same time, she's getting ready to die, and she didn't want to be alone. So I sat there holding her arm like that. The doctor pulled out the tube, and then we just sat there as she slowly slipped away. And it's hard to describe how profound that was for me. And I felt a very close connection with her. Well, then as I turned back, the husband and the daughter couldn't take it anymore, and they actually stepped out into the hallway. You can still see in the room because it's glass. The son was hanging out at the door, and I could tell he didn't want to leave her. He wanted some sort of intimate personal connection, but he just didn't know how to do it. And now, you know, she's gone. So I looked at him and I invited him over and asked him to take my place. And I stood up and I sat him down and I put his hand in her hand like mine was, and my other hand, his hand on her arm the way I had had it. And I just asked him to take over. And he sat there and he connected, and he just sat there with her for several minutes. What was in his mind and heart, I don't know. But it just was so obvious that he needed that. And it's something that he will, I think, remember and feel that he was able to accomplish or cherish for the rest of his life, that he was able to make that personal connection with his mother at that time. Those are the kinds of profound experiences that can be shared if you approach this without fear, if you approach it with love, and if you approach it with honor and gratitude for being able to be with people at these times. It's amazing.
You know, there's an element of pastoral care that doesn't readily come to mind, and that is being present with the prisoner, the convict, the outcast, the one who's caused the suffering. Jason mentioned earlier Stanley Hauerwas. There's one of his works in particular that I keep going back to. It's called The Suffering Presence: Theological Reflections on Medicine, the Mentally Handicapped, and the Church. That's published by Notre Dame University Press. But he, on page 34, he cites, "One's own sorrow is nothing, but the sorrow one has caused to others makes bitter the bread in the mouth." And I think of men and women who have hurt their own children, either out of rage or perverted lusts, and who torment themselves, who are conscious and perfectly aware of the ongoing and perpetual torment of their children. We had a soldier in 2005 who received a Red Cross message that his little daughter was being taken to the hospital for second and third degree burns on her body, and the prognosis was questionable. The command made the quick decision to send this young sergeant back on emergency leave from Iraq to Georgia. We found out while he was flying over the Atlantic that the cause of the burns was were a result of the mother who, in a snap anger, tossed a pan of boiling water she had on the stove onto their young daughter. I think she was 5 or 6. By the time his plane landed, their daughter had died. And so, as you might imagine, with this terrible event, this soldier is now in the position of, how does he respond? How does he care for his wife? How does he deal with the... And so his wife is now having charges read against her. She's in prison. He's got buddies back in Iraq who are in a combat environment for whom he also feels responsible. And so the young guy understandably had to wait of the world on his soldiers. So between the rear deployment chaplain back at Fort Stewart and me back in Iraq, it was a combined effort to really make sense of that situation for the soldier, for his fellow soldiers who were all beside themselves because they knew his wife well. They knew his daughter. They had spent time at barbecues prior to the deployment over at their homes. And, you know, just one of many experiences that I know we've all had where you really have to, you struggle to make sense of the situation only to realize that you can't make sense of the situation, how someone could live his or her life so, I wouldn't say flawless, but in an overwhelmingly healthy way, but at one critical juncture of poor choice or chance or mistake or what have you, great pain and suffering and loss comes as a result. And so I guess to reemphasize the principle, some of the more difficult situations, it is healthy to communicate that, wow, this is big, this is heavy, this is bewildering, this is puzzling. It's bigger than you, it's bigger than me. I don't have a whole lot of answers for you right now. And that type of solidarity, if you will, although not what we want, can be helpful. I learned a lesson from my father, although not with this particular intent in mind, that the three sweetest words in the English language were not "I love you," but "I don't know." And it really helps the sufferer know that he or she is alone.
Thank you so much, Nathan. I really appreciate that. And boy, yeah, that is so hard indeed to think of the suffering of those who cause the pain for whatever reason. So thank you. Wonderful. Jason, you ready to take the lead some more?
One of the things you asked earlier was, you know, are there books or things like that? And something I've read recently that's kind of resonated with my pastoral experience is a book by a guy by the name of John Swinton. John Swinton is I believe he's Scottish, or at least he's out of the University of Aberdeen up in Scotland. And he wrote a book called Raging with Compassion. It's a beautiful title.
Yeah.
Raging with Compassion, Pastoral Responses to the Problem of Evil. And what he does is he looks to the crucifixion scene, and he looks to what Jesus is doing in his suffering, right? And what Jesus is doing in his suffering, he's doing a couple things, right? He's lamenting, right? My God, why have you forsaken me? He's practicing forgiveness, right? Forgive them, for they know, Father, forgive them. They know not what they're doing. And then he's reaching out to the people who are there, the people who showed up, family and friends, right? He's commending his mother into John's care. And so he takes each of these and tries to draw out pastoral practice from them. And so if it's all right with you, if I just like to take just a few minutes and kind of and talk about each of these as an extension of pastoral care.
Please.
So he starts with lament, and we've talked about a little bit about this earlier when we were talking about wisdom literature, right? But the Gospel of Mark reads, at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice saying, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And this is Jesus quoting, you know, the 22nd Psalm, and which is just this great psalm of lament, right? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring, right? O God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and I am not silent. And so, you know, recovering this language of lament, I think, can be really helpful spiritually and pastorally, right? Lament is a spiritual practice, allows for us bringing a complaint to God, bringing our sense that, you know, where are you, God? I don't see you in this. But like I said before, right, even doing that, even bringing our complaint to God, even you know, crying out, saying, you know, where are you, God? You seem far away from me right now, right? There's a bit of hope behind that, right? That hope that God will hear, that God will have an answer, or a response, or some action or presence, you know, as that we can recognize as as we cry out, right? It's a way of moving towards God, right? To lament is to engage God and hope God that will hear and respond. And we can do this pastorally, right? We can, you know, lament can be practiced as a prayer. It can be written out as a poem. It can be just a way of bringing pain to language. Right. And I remember I was working at an Army hospital, not the one I'm working at now, but a different one. And I had met this guy. He was a retired officer, very senior in rank, and was HIV positive, and was just having this unidentified stomach pain, right? He was in a lot of pain. The docs were trying to figure out exactly what was causing it, and he was just in pain. And the first time I met him, he was so insistent. I'd barely walked in the door and introduced myself as, you know, Chaplain Unsworth, when he just kind of grabbed onto me and said, I've always tried to live a good life. I don't know why this is happening to me. Tell me why this is happening to me. And he was so insistent in his pain that it kind of took me by surprise. And I took a moment to kind of take a breath and kind of pause and gather my thoughts. And that was too long for him, because he shook me and said, answer me. We had I think that first time I talked to him, we had what I would call probably a fairly unsatisfying conversation for him, right? That he in his desperation and me in my, you know, at that moment in my anxiety and fumbling around, you know, probably just didn't really offer him much. I mean, I tried to get him to a reflective space where he could kind of talk about what he was going through and just, you know, I tried just to be with her with him in that moment, but he seemed to he really struggled, and I struggled in response to him. Fast forward to a couple days later, after this kind of disappointing initial meeting, I went to see him, and they moved him out of the ICU, and he was in one of the normal, or, you know, right there on our regular medical surgical floor. And I saw that he had a copy of the Bible next to him, and I almost, you know, the second I saw that he'd been reading scripture, I started thinking about, well, maybe there's a verse I could share with him. And fortunately, I immediately squashed that thought and said, who cares what I'm reading? I want to know what he's reading. I want to know what he's getting out of that book. And so I asked him, I said, what have you been reading? And he pointed to the Psalms. And he says that he's been reading a lot in the Psalms. And I asked, well, has that been helpful to you? And he said, oh, enormously. And so, I mean, his attitude had really changed at this point. That desperation wasn't there. I think, you know, the docs had helped him out and maybe got some news. But I asked him, well, what has reading the Psalms done for you? And he said, well, they just really speak to what I'm going through right now. And I asked him if there was a particular psalm that's especially meaningful. And he said, yeah. And so he brings out Psalm 13. And I'm going to read, it was one of the Message translations. And so, and remember, here's somebody who's, you know, who just has intense stomach pain, who's, you know, been going through all these procedures to try and figure it out. And no good answers have come. And so he reads Psalm 13 to me. He says, long enough, God, you've ignored me long enough. I've looked back at your head. I've looked at the back of your head long enough. I've carried this ton of trouble, lived with a stomach full of pain. And so reading that psalm, you know, which kind of has a kind of a lament aspect to it, kind of became a way of him bringing that complaint to God, right? That was him using that to bring language to his pain. Long enough, God, long enough, you've ignored me with this stomach full of pain. And the interesting thing is, though, is that he talked about how, yeah, it was helpful for him to bring that complaint to God, to have that just crying out, long enough, where are you, God? But he said that reading that helped him to move to Psalm 121. And so then he opens up to Psalm 121 and reads, I look up to the mountains. Does my strength come from mountains? No. My strength comes from God, who made heaven and earth and the mountains. And so then he started telling me how those verses were so meaningful to him, how he moved from lament to this expression of faith, but he couldn't get there without crying out, you know, the Psalm 13, long enough, God, you've ignored me long enough. And I thought about that, right? Moving from one to the other, how he did that. And I thought of the placing of the 22nd Psalm, right? Because if we want to read Psalm 23,
The Lord is my shepherd.
The Lord is my shepherd, right? Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you're with me. If we want to get to Psalm 23, we got to get through Psalm 22 first. And that's my God, why have you forsaken me? And so just talking to this man really kind of emphasized that point, how engaging God through lament, whether it's through reading it in scripture as he was, and then using that as a way to express his feelings, to be honest about his emotions and say, I'm angry and I'm hurting, I'm in pain, and I don't know where God is, and I need something right now. As a way of moving to a, what for him, at least the way he described it to me, was a space where he did feel like that God was present in his suffering. And so I thought that was helpful. I mean, his story I thought was it was helpful to me, at least, to understand that movement and how lament really could be used spiritually and pastorally.
Awesome. I don't want to lose your framing of this talking about Jesus, so keep going.
Okay. Well, going on in this book, this Raging with Compassion book, he talks about forgiveness, right? And he quotes the Luke scripture where Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing," right? And talks about forgiveness as a spiritual and pastoral response to suffering, right? That forgiveness is relational, that we forgive people, not acts. And that forgiveness can be healing, but you know, pastorally, I'm always really cautious to not want to move somebody towards forgiveness who's not ready yet, right? Some hurts are so deep that you can't just glibly say, "Oh, well, you need to forgive them and move on with it."
Right.
Some hurts are too deep. And I think of Richard G. Scott talk on healing the shattering consequences of abuse, where Elder Scott says that, yes, you know, healing or forgiveness is an important part of healing, but if the thought of forgiveness causes you yet more pain, put it aside. Put it aside until you have more experience with the Savior's healing power in your own life, right? You know, if you can't forgive yet, that's okay. Just keep working with the Savior in your own woundedness. And I thought that was pastorally wise of Elder Scott to say that we don't have to rush to forgive. And sometimes we just need to turn our rage and our unforgiveness over to God. If we can't do it ourselves, maybe the only response then is to turn it over to God who forgives all. Maybe I can't, but you know, you think of some of those other psalms, right? Like Psalm 58, which is this amazing psalm of vengeance, right? Where, you know, God, those who are oppressing me and bringing me pain, you know, break their teeth, melt them, let them melt away like water, right? That the person who's crying out isn't seeking that revenge. They're turning their rage over to God, and God's going to do either act on that rage or forgive as God will. But the person who's, you know, the person who's calling out to God at least is not enacting that vengeance themselves.
Right.
And then the other thing that this book kind of wraps up with is in our pain and our suffering, turning to those relationships that can be the most healing, the most supportive, the most sustaining, right? And he quotes from John 19, "When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. And then he said to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her into his own home." And just kind of speaking to the power of compassionate relationship and the idea of Christian and familial solidarity, right? The people who show up in my woundedness, the people who show up in my darkest hours, in my time of pain, and recognizing the people who are there and knowing that, you know, sometimes we just need someone to sit with. Sometimes we need people there. If it's all right with you, could I read something really quick?
Please.
Okay. I was thinking about this. I was thinking about the power of relationships and attending to grief. And I remembered something I wrote back when I was a chaplain resident. This is there was a terrible accident. There was a car accident, and a couple who was due to be engaged were in a car accident along with I believe the man who was to be the best man at their wedding. The two men in the car ended up dying. And the only survivor was the woman, and they were all brought to the hospital where I was a chaplain, and I was it was on a Saturday, and I was the only chaplain in the hospital at the time. I was the duty chaplain, and I got the call and was informed that the man who I believe was the to be the best man, that he was dying, and that the staff there in the ICU wanted me to be there for the family. And so I'm just going to read immediately after this experience. I went and I wrote this down. It was part of my residency process. And so I'm just going to write down my narrative of that. I'm going to read, my narrative of that moment. And so this is right after the event happened. So there's no, it's rough. This is not polished writing or anything like that. This is just kind of my immediate kind of recollection of what went down. I go to the ICU where Paul, and I'm just calling him Paul, but where Paul is surrounded by docs, nurses, and his mother and stepfather. His mother is holding onto his hand, whispering into his ear. The stepfather pulls me aside and says, "We've already lost one son to a drunk driver. We can't lose another one. Our pastor promised us that we would never lose another one like this." I'm in shock. How can this family go through this again? What the hell was this stupid pastor thinking when he made that promise? All I can do is put my hand on his shoulder and say words like, "I hear you. I'm sorry." I pray that if God has any miracle today, that he will bless this young man with life. But if not, may something be present with this family. May it. The time comes for me to speak to Paul's mother. Based on what I heard from the staff and what I heard from the stepfather, I assume that she will be in full denial. However, I'm wrong. Her grief is deep, but she knows that her son is dying, and she accepts that terrible truth. The nurse says it will be any minute now. We pull a chair over to Paul's side as his mother sits, holds his hand, and tells him how much she loves him and how much God loves him. It is beautiful and heart-wrenching. The stepfather stands behind her, holding her. I stand behind him with my hand on his shoulder. The nurse cannot find a pulse. The doctor comes in and pronounces Paul dead. Paul's mother lets out a wail of grief that crashes into me. My heart jumps and I let out a sob. The mother's strength evaporates as she collapses onto her dead son. The next hour is a blur. I stay in the room, comforting and holding the mother and stepfather. There are no good words, only "I'm sorry" and listening. The stepfather pulls me aside again. I think he's going to be angry because of the promise of the pastor. Thank God I'm wrong. He is full of faith. He says when they lost the first son, they were not notified in time, and they were not able to be at his side when he died. He's grateful to God that they were able to be at Paul's side when he passed. I am relieved. The family waits in the waiting room while the staff clean Paul's body up. More and more family and friends arrive. The women counsel with the mother while the stepfather busies himself with phone calls and logistical details. The busyness of attending to grief. I have short conversations with each, mostly holding and listening. I offer encouragement by reinforcing their gratitude at being able to be at his side and to be with the family. I listen to their sense of loss and the love that they had for Paul. I'm mindful of my own anger at the injustice of his death at the hands of a drunk driver. At some time, the family is let back into the room. The mother climbs into bed with Paul and just holds him. Family and friends go in and out. I sense that they're doing well and don't really need me as a constant presence. So I mostly stay out of the room, but keep close and available. I talk to the stepfather as he goes in and out. He's trying to be the strong one and take care of everybody. I try and take care of him and just listen and hold on to his shoulder. He seems to appreciate it. I go in the room and find the family surrounding the bed in prayer. They beat me to it. I feel as if I failed them by not arranging this sooner. However, I'm also grateful that they came to prayer naturally as a family without me. Perhaps I was right in my assessment that they did not need me very much. I let the family attend to each other, occasionally focusing on the stepfather to see how he's holding up. He's doing well. There's a strength to this family. They've been through this before. I occasionally attend to the mother. She stays on the bed with Paul. She is better attended by family. Their pastor shows up and leads in more prayer. I make contact with her and let her know that I am present if she needs anything. She seems to be grateful for the backup. The nursing staff is getting restless. Paul's body will need to go to the morgue soon. I advocate for another half hour. The stepfather is grateful. He thinks he can get them out in time. They leave. They express appreciation for my care. I feel both affirmed and also inadequate. I wish I could have done more, but I also don't think they needed me more. And so, you know, revisiting my recollection of that, you know, brought a couple of things home, right? One is how reaching out to suffering, sometimes there's just a busyness to it, right? You're moving amongst people, you're maybe holding on to them, maybe you're just offering what little words of encouragement or compassion you can. And it also reminded me just of how families and the people who we care about the most, right? Whether it's family, friends, their pastor showed up, right? It gets back to Hauerwas and those communities of care, right? How do we resist suffering and evil? Not through some elaborate theodicy, but through communities of care. And that's kind of what I saw with this family as they kind of took care of each other. And then I became an increasingly less important person in that room, right? As the family started taking care of itself, they didn't really need a chaplain so much. I mean, I was still there and still present and available, but been watching them take care of each other, of them, and watching the family take care of each other. And then my work kind of slowly became more and more on the margins as the family did its work of caring for each other.
Oh man, thank you.
And so that's, you know, that I appreciate Swinton's work of pushing from theoretical theodicies to more practical theodicies, right? How do we respond to suffering, right? And his view of looking to the crucifixion scene and to see, well, what is Jesus doing in his suffering? He's lamenting, he's forgiving, he's recognizing the family and the people who are there present and commending them to each other. And what can that tell us about our own pastoral work, whether it's as a chaplain or whether it's as a bishop or a home teacher or just because you're a neighbor or a family member, right? There's something there, I think, that can inform our reaching out and our practice.
Wonderful. Phil, a story or anything that came up for you during that?
I actually need to go provide some care for my mother, so let me mention a few things and I'm going to bail out on you. Obviously, it is important to meet folks where they are. And many times it's people who are angry at God, and I try to help them give voice to that. And I try to assure them that in the circumstance that they're in, you know, their anger, their frustration, their fear is understandable, and God doesn't get mad at them or, you know, doesn't consider it a sin to go through that lamenting, really. I actually affirm folks in that lamentation and expression of distress. And it is a kind of a cleansing, sort of healing thing for them to be able to do that rather than to stifle that, as long as it's not unusual or excessive. I do think meaning is important. I think Jason mentioned earlier that when there is meaning to things, it's much easier to endure them. I love the quote from Francois Fenelon, an archbishop in the 1600s and 1700s. He said, "I pray the Lord that we may none of us fall into the torpid state in which our crosses do us no good." I certainly try to avoid imposing meaning. I try to serve really as a midwife as people struggle to give birth to their own meaning. And I've had many people thank me afterwards for advice I never gave.
Nice.
You know, they were really crystallizing this in their own mind and somehow thought I had said things that really came out of their own awareness. But where I can tactfully, I try to assist in the birth of meaning. Also, as I can, because I believe so much of our suffering occurs when there is a divorce or a separation between our normal human experience and our inner divine nature, I always try to do what I can, if people are up to it, to help them have an experience of themselves, of their inner being, or their to have some sort of experience with their own divinity, their own goodness inside. I think that first verse in the Book of Mormon where Nephi says, I was highly favored of the Lord, nevertheless suffered many afflictions. I mean, that's in the first verse, this message is communicated that you can have many afflictions and still be highly favored of the Lord. And I find that people need that. They need to know that they can experience a significant amount of suffering and trauma and affliction, but still be acceptable and highly favored of the Lord. If folks aren't quite up to the divine nature thing I'm trying to do, then I will look for something I can affirm within them. I was visiting a lady in a nursing home in Bountiful, LDS lady, who was absolutely convinced that she wasn't going to make it to the celestial kingdom because she didn't have enough knowledge. She would quote that verse in the DNC about knowledge and taking it with you and so forth. And when you went into her room, it was a bit hilarious because she had, these hospital tables piled full of books. I mean, they were 6, 8, 10 books high. And then she had a tape recorder with talks from general authorities. So she'd read from a book until she got tired, and then she'd listen to a talk from a general authority. And then she'd read a book, and then she'd listen to a talk. And she was just wearing herself out, stressed, trying to get enough knowledge to get into the kingdom. And one day after I talked to one of her daughters and learned about her life and the amazing things that she suffered and did to raise 5 children with a substantial number of health problems, and to do it in a way that just brought about their admiration and respect and love was, just remarkable experiences. The next day I went in to see her, she's giving me a report on her studies and expressing her fear that she just still didn't know enough. And I said, can we read one verse from the Book of Mormon? And she said, well, sure. And I said, this is the only reading I want to be done in here today, and I just want you to think about this. And so I read the verse where Moroni said, if you're possessed of love at the last day, it will be well with you. And then I shared with her what her children had shared with me about her life and how they saw her and experienced her. And there was no question that what they were describing was a person possessed of love. And, she looked at me and she said, I can't remember the exact words, but it was, wow, do you think I will be acceptable to the Lord, even if I don't learn anything else? And I just read the verse again, and I said, if anybody's possessed of love, it's you, and there's many witnesses here to that. And the next day I went in there was one book.
All right.
So the idea is to find something true that can be affirmed to uplift this person in the midst of their suffering. I do take a lot of stock in this verse in Romans 8 where it says we'll be joint heirs with Christ if so be that we suffer with him. That implies to me that he's willing to be with us in our suffering, and I work very hard to communicate the love and compassion of Christ and to get people to believe that if they'll open their minds and hearts, his presence will come to them in their suffering, and that he not only wants to be with them, he desires to be with them, he will be with them if they'll open and receive his presence and love. And then finally, there's this key verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says, when a person responds to the joys and sorrows of others as if they were his own, he has attained the highest state of spiritual union. And that's a guide for me. I want to be compassionate. I want to be with people in their joys and in their sufferings. And it does require a desire for spiritual union with others. If you're not connected with them at some deep soul level, then it is hard to treat their joys and their sorrows as if they were your own. I believe that soul connection is possible, and it doesn't take extraordinary training to do it. I think each person can open themselves up to be able to do that and assist people in their trials and in their sufferings. So I have found little in life that's as enjoyable. I have to admit, like Jason said, when I first started going to the hospital as a military chaplain, I was horrified. What to say, what to do, how to fix things, the magic words, the magic prayer that would make everything okay. And you know, you suddenly realize that you just have to go with love and no fear. And good things happen spiritually when you have that confidence and you have that attitude and you have that desire to literally share in the sufferings of others. And it's been one of the great blessings of my life, and I hope I can continue to do it for as long as I'm able.
Thank you so much for all of that and for everything else on this podcast. Anything that Jason or Nathan has to say to Phil before he drops off?
Good to visit with you again, Phil.
Absolutely. Thanks for your perspective.
Oh, it's always meaningful to be with you guys.
Well, we'll do it again in a few months. But by the time we're over here, I'll prime people to suggest the next topic for the Chaplains On, our series. Cool. Anyway, thanks so much, Phil. We'll talk to you later. Good night.
Thanks, guys.
Nathan, is there any more positive perspectives or remember this or that you have? Otherwise, I'm going to take you into a nice thing that in our exchange before, which is about, yeah, we get it wrong so often. You gave a good framing of, you know, the frustration that we have when pastoral leaders, especially lay leaders in Mormonism, you know, maybe don't get it right. So I want you to go positive and kind of keep with the main theme, or else go right to there if you don't mind.
I do have a short story that very well may serve as a segue. So like Jason and Phil, we've got so many experiences, you know, countless stories of heartache and things that we've done that we failed miserably at, things where we struggled and came out on top in the end. You know, we felt there was a sense of success or victory. The thought that came to my mind while listening to both Jason and Phil was something that I observed or heard third hand. I was teaching gospel doctrine about 13, 14 years ago. I can't remember what the lesson was on, but I asked the question, what does loving one another look like? And this was in the Hyde Park ward, and it has an interesting dynamic. I would say about a third of the ward are African American. There's a mix between economic, socioeconomic status, educational status, you know, livelihood, culture, race. It's just a fun place to live the gospel. And, you know, I asked this question, how do you know when someone loves you? What does it look like? And there was this middle-aged black sister who said, well, love looks like this. And she went on to recount a story of her home teacher, who at the time was the bishop of the ward, middle-aged white guy, you know, businessman who worked for a tech company, long list of ways in which his life and what it looked like contrasted starkly with hers. And she was ill. Her illness put her up in bed. She wasn't able to be on her feet. She lost her job. And he came to visit her. And while visiting, he did a few loads of laundry, folded the laundry, put it away, visited with her while he was doing that, told some funny stories, by which time she was and kind of worked through her surprise and comfort and realized that my home teacher, you know, my bishop, he's for real. And when he asked, you know, what can I get you? And she said, well, I don't know why, but I got a hankering for toast and marmalade. And she goes, I think there's some marmalade in the top cabinet. And, you know, he went in and there was no marmalade. He just made a quick walk to the corner store, got some marmalade, came back. They shared some toast and marmalade, and then he left. And, you know, the sister didn't spare any details, and she kind of looked to her left and right, and he folded my skivvies. You know, it was well outside of my comfort zone, merely hearing that. And this is an incredibly unassuming man. You wouldn't think anything if you saw him. He just kind of blends in as the everyman, if you will. But to this day, you know, on a fairly regular basis, I'm reminded that pastoral care doesn't have to look like, it doesn't have to appear in the clinical and theological framework that we've been discussing it. It can simply look like service. It can look like washing someone's feet. It can look like forgiveness, any number of types of service.
And just so, being something to sit with, right?
Yeah, I mean, Jason very likely knows the person I'm speaking of. And, you know, here it is, what, 13, 14 years later, and it's one of the most dominant visual images, even though I didn't see it myself in my mind because of this sister's candid telling of the story. And there were quite a few eyebrows that lifted while she started to share it. And it wasn't one of those overly sweet where, you know, the spirit was so strong and there wasn't a dry eye in the room. It was just a very vivid description of what it means to be present with someone. And there was no vertical, you know, he's bishop and she's a member, he's, you know, home teacher, she's the home teachee. It was very horizontal, brother, sister, and across all kinds of social boundaries, the love of Christ was manifest. And I'd never had the thought until now, but and I certainly wouldn't mean to offend anyone, but in a manner of speaking, the unity and renewal that we have at the sacrament table over the bread was very similar in fashion, if you think about what was happening with the toast and the marmalade.
Mm.
And so I share that just as an illustration that pastoral care can take all forms.
Beautiful. And Jason, do you have any more like advice, best practices? So I kind of want to get to training for us, you know, us listeners.
Yeah. No, I really don't. I think we kind of covered the points I wanted to, and I appreciate, you know, what Phil and Nathan brought in. So absolutely, we can move on.
Okay. Well, Nathan, let me do a better job of prompting you. During our email exchanges, we brought up, well, it was based upon that original letter that came in. The writer talked about getting poor, you know, she wasn't, her pain and her suffering wasn't acknowledged. It was more of a like, you know, cheer up, just work harder, you can get to it, and things like that. And it sort of led us to have, yes, a little bit of an exchange about, you know, lay leadership within Mormonism. You guys are professional, you know, professionals. You've had training. You spoke of some classes that you took at the Divinity School that you said, without these, you know, they very much helped you and things like that. So I kind of wanted to just take your perspective on lay leaders who don't have training and share what's out there for us so that we can do better. And also, you just had this nice little take of, we need to be forgiving that people don't have expertise in this.
Yes, I'm sure Jason and Phil would tell you the same thing. There's not been a ward to which I've belonged at since being a chaplain that the bishops haven't enthusiastically and with relief welcomed us and considered among the many callings that we had to be a stake special, you know, or welfare specialist, I think is what I was called in Germany. And all the times there are needs that families have that bishops can't directly speak to. And so when a legal issue comes up, you know, that the church has a legal department, but many times, you know, they have to go off and get legal advice. The church's family service department, great training can be provided, but more often than not, it's resources that are made available to bishops, brass presidents, stake presidents, etc. And so in many instances, there's this assumption that somehow the keys of, you know, the mantle and the keys associated with the calling of bishop or stake president carries along with it all the credentials you would need, mm-hmm, to provide for any type of need to, you know, someone in suffering, for instance. And I think many of our bishops, some of whom I know from their own experience, will be the first to tell you, you know, I can counsel you spiritually. I can pray and fast for you and with you. But we need to get you some help in addition to what I'm able to provide you as your ecclesiastical leader, you know, as your priesthood leader. And I'm encouraged by bishops who recognize other resources out there. At the same time, there is no hard line between what you do as a home teacher and, you know, when home teaching is just home teaching and when it becomes pastoral care, where an interview with your bishop or counseling with the bishop is just has to do with, you know, worthiness to attend the temple or whatever, and then when it becomes pastoral care. There's all kinds of overlap there. So since no one is demanding it anyway, for the most part, it can only help for our various leaders. And of course, I include, you know, those in all the auxiliaries, the Relief Society and primary to say, how can I bolster, how can I shore up my expertise level? What can I learn from universities, colleges in my area, online? What books can I read? That type of thing. And certainly not just in pastoral care, but what primary or what teacher doesn't in the long run improve his or her or magnify his or her calling by doing research on styles of pedagogy and philosophies of, you know, education. That said, I'm reminded of something I once heard where, you know, is there anything more dangerous than someone with a little philosophy?
Right.
So you've got to get past that mark of, you know, that the minimum, that benchmark, and the only way to do that is to continue on. And so, Jason, don't know how you feel about this, but I would strongly encourage, you know, we are a complete lay ministry. There's a minimal degree of training associated with, you know, some of our callings and none associated with other of the callings. Any thoughts on how people might, I don't know, kind of take the training into their own hands and make use of the abundance of resources out there?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. There's wisdom out there to be found, right? And we're counseled to seek wisdom out of the best books. And I'm always a little hesitant, just due to my, you know, my own background and information and academic training. I recognize there's a tendency within me to think that the answer to a lot of these questions, as far as, you know, how I can grow or improve, that the answers to that are found in a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. and that just, you know, and that because, you know, that and that comes from my own, you know, my own background in philosophy and my own graduate work, and that the first thing, you know, every time I think about, well, how can I grow in this area? How can I grow to be a more compassionate, empathetic person? One of the first thoughts that comes to my mind is, well, there's probably a book out there that I should read. and there are great books out there. I, you know what I mean? I'm working on another degree right now, and I'm reading a lot of books, and many of them are very helpful and do kind of help me form a sense of, you know, that reinforce the training I've had as far as, you know, being comfortable with silence, you know, not rushing to speak, but listening first and let that listening inform my speech. And so, you know, the things I read out of some of these books are helpful, but also just being open to, and I don't know, this is going to sound corny or hokey, right? But just learning from life, learning from my experience, being able to practice kind of an action reflection kind of process, right? Where I meet somebody and I engage with them in their suffering and I offer what I can, and then I offer that action of pastoral care, and then reflect on it afterwards, right? What happened in that moment? What was my response? Why did I say what I did, or why did I do what I did? And kind of do that self-evaluation, that after-action reflection, and then re-engage, and then go back to, you know, the next time a situation comes up, I'm, you know, maybe I've modified my approach. And so I don't know, maybe I'm getting off the subject here, but I think, you know, as we as people, when it comes to how can we better reach out to each other, right? I mean, I think there's plenty of great books that I could recommend to people. but there's also just being aware of those needs of, you know, attitudinal shifts, right? Where we need to step back and we need to realize that even though we find comfort in the gospel and even though we have trust in the gospel, right? That the gospel is not a therapy that I can just apply to somebody else's pain. That hopefully the gospel is informing my compassionate response to them, but that the gospel itself is not a therapy in any kind of clinical sense. And so what I need to do is just to be a thoughtful person. And that's going to help me approach people with maybe a little bit more intentionality. I don't know. Is that making sense?
It does. I think that to say a little bit more about the thoughtful part, it assumes a self-awareness. When you do after action, what did you call it? After action?
Just kind of an action reflection model.
Reflection. Right. So, when you reflect after being present with someone, I think any leader would benefit from saying, well, what were my feelings? What did I want to happen? How might that have not been in harmony with what the person I was there to serve and care for wanted or needed?
Right. What were their needs and what were my needs? Right. Being aware of your own needs and how sometimes maybe you push for those rather than responding to the need present in the other person. Yeah.
And it's that kind of lack of awareness that will cause someone to say, well, all things will be for your good. So count it a victory, count it a blessing, or again, the platitudes that so often will hinder someone's healing as opposed to facilitate it. There probably isn't anything that I would think is more essential to our further development than increasing our self-awareness. And to the extent that we can evaluate our intentions and our actions over and against our values. And then, of course, secondly, to further hone and better be more able to articulate what those values are.
Nathan, you did mention in some emails, I thought, a couple of classes that you took with great titles. For instance, you had one called Mourning and Melancholia. Another class called Suffering, Loss, and Memory. And so I guess in my mind it was like your immersion in those classes, you know, certainly there was a reading list, and it seems like we've been focusing on, oh, what would be the reading list if there was one, and we're kind of saying no. But is there anything that could sort of like help a person enter into the head or heart space, you know, that kind of emerged for you through those classes or something? I guess I'm just looking for something broad like that.
Are you asking me if there are particular works or classes that people could take?
Well, that or just if you wanted to even maybe just you just riffing on, you know, that class and what the essential things that came out of it, if you can remember those. Because it'll just, you know, enough for us. Because I took one called Hiroshima, well, the Holocaust and Hiroshima, you know, like the two great 20th century major, you know, where the hell is God when this kind of crap goes on, you know, kind of things. And it's been effective my entire, you know, 25 years since then. So I'm just kind of, and I could probably name a few reasons why, but so that's what I'm just trying to get a little shorthand into that, if you have
so
it.
I think it's 2001. Yes, it was. It was 2001, Mourning, Loss, and Melancholia with Peter Holmans at the University of Chicago. And a lot of this was psychology and, you know, steep psychology, but we kept pulling from the psychology the pastoral element, and then we looked at art and memorializing, and it was a rich class coming from multiple angles, much more sophisticated than I would have thought such a subject. You know, what is there to say about loss except that it sucks? You know, what is there to say about, you know, mourning except that I don't want to do it and sometimes I have to? I don't mean to be so glib, but it was open to become a much more profound and, as I said, sophisticated seminar. And what I, as I did the various readings and had conversations and dialogue in our courses, I came to identify a project. It took place, it coincided with the rebuilding and rededication of the Nauvoo Temple on the other side of the state. And at the time, my calling was the multi-state public affairs director in the Chicagoland area. So we had, I don't know, like 13 stakes, it seemed. And so I was very much involved in getting religious leaders and others to be a part of the open house in the Nauvoo Temple. And, of course, this is, so it's all coming clear, more clearly to me now. This is in the fall or early winter of 2001, not too long after September 11th. And it struck me that, you know, some of the first impulses from the society at large to September 11th was, in our horror with the Twin Towers coming down, we're going to build them right back the way they were. And, you know, thankfully, cooler heads prevailed, more thoughtful, more considered individuals saying, well, now our impulse to do that may in part be a resiliency, you know, that we are strong. But we also, we can't forget those who lost lives and those who will move on from here mourning forever the loss of loved ones and then the collective, you know, damage that that caused. And to merely build it right back up is to concretize our sense of denial. And although, depending on whom you ask, you know, that could be a very healthy step in the process of, you know, moving through grief, that's an open conversation right now, may even be a moot point, but it's not the end point. One might go through a sense of denial, but one has to continue to progress to come to terms or find meaning for that loss. And so it's interesting now in 2013 that we're looking at the construction of the building in its place, looking quite a bit different, and yet not somehow retaining a memory of what had happened while moving forward. And yet here we have the Nauvoo Temple rebuilt almost to exact specifications in many senses. And as we went through the temple with the different religious leaders, our tours, and we got kind of special tours since we had VIPs with us, our tour guides seemed to go at great length to emphasize that this is a replica of the building. And one of the gentlemen that was with me, Rabbi Ira Yudevin, who at the time was the president of the Chicago Board of Rabbis, and as he's going through this with me, he turns to me and he says, there seems to be a great value of history that is being covered over and hidden from present and future generations. And for a devout Jew to say that to me, who has clearly learned, and one might argue from mistake, the harm of denying or forgetting the suffering of your people or you as a nation, that lesson just really sunk in. And without that course, without understanding the psychology behind why we build monuments, why we have ceremonies, funerals, we in the military, memorial ceremonies, you know, there's a distinct difference in the Army between a memorial ceremony in combat, for instance, and the funeral that takes place with the family members back in the States. Different audiences, different purposes, different elements in the traditions and the ceremonies, and for entirely different reasons. There are a couple of instances of what takes place in a memorial ceremony that is incredibly shocking, and the few times where we have family members attend memorial ceremonies that happen on Army posts, we chaplains are quite intentional about informing and warning the family ahead of time, look, there's going to be a couple things in here that will be startling to you. There will be a last roll call where the soldier's first sergeant shouts out the name of someone in the audience and he replies, here, first sergeant, and then another one. And then the third one is the name of the deceased. And so, for instance, you know, Private Jones, and there's no answer. Private John Jones, and there's no answer. Private John Samuel Jones, and there's no answer. And the firing of volleys, the 21-gun salute, taps sounds, and it's a very poignant moment designed for that soldier's unit to come alongside one another and to refocus their efforts on the mission without forgetting their brother who was lost, or sister, if that be the case. Whereas the family, in these few instances, when they choose or are able to be present, they really need to be warned because they have a much different need, understandably. And so this course with Peter Homans in evaluating the psychology, what happens to individuals who experience extreme loss and extreme mourning, how architecture and art are imbued with meaning and purpose, and how we can more intentionally be sensitive and respectful to those that we're attempting to honor. How do you learn those things except through the aid of experts who have dedicated their lives to the reflection of these very extremely fine points of human existence? And I don't think you can. And so it's in no way, shape, or form a criticism of our lay leaders, again, whom I've pointed out in all instances that I've experienced, welcome us chaplains to their wards each time we're transferred and stationed from place to place. And I don't know that there's actually a final answer. I'm certainly not advocating for a professional ministry. But on the other hand, I'm certainly aware of the benefits that are available to those of us who are more professionally and clinically trained to provide that ministry.
Right. And here we are with a listening audience that we're now in the fourth hour, you know, of this podcast, who I think what you've given there in this one example, again, this is the kind of audience that wants to do better, you know, that wants to be in service of these things. And so thank you for sharing that, because that's a very concrete example, memorializing. What is the purpose of funerals and services, and who are the different audiences, and all those different things helps us, again, to think of these things that now it's up to us to read and think on. Why don't we just stop there at that point on this, you know, business about training, and simply say, I appreciate if you guys can just come to the blog, and if anybody wants to engage you personally, let's make sure that happens.
Absolutely.
Does that feel okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Perfect on that. Guys, what's left? Is there some final thoughts that either of you have about your hopes and your best desires for us as a LDS community as we serve each other?
I guess what I would always encourage people who are reaching out to others in times of suffering is to take care of yourselves as well, right? I mean, suffering, you know, other people's suffering, other people's vulnerabilities, you know, can certainly open up our own vulnerabilities and our own limits, right? And that none of us, no matter how compassionate and loving we are, none of us are, you know, Superman or Superwoman, right? And I keep getting back to this Hauerwas quote about having communities of care, right? Having a team-based approach where, I mean, sometimes the one who's in pain or distress, I'm all they've got, right? And I need to be, you know, there for them in that moment. But hopefully that when it comes to the way we comfort each other, when it comes to our counseling, right, that we're not alone in it, right? That we have a team-based approach, right? As an Army chaplain at a hospital, you know, it's not just me, but there's nurses and doctors and all of us, you know, trying to care for not just the patient, but also certainly their family as well, right? So that you know, reaching out to them in their time of suffering and pain, you know, that reaching out isn't just one person. It's not just that one nurse or not just that one chaplain. And so hopefully that, you know, that we can as Latter-day Saints and in our own and our other all the other communities that we participate in, that we have that kind of team-based approach, right? When it comes to reaching out to others, because it can be exhausting, because it can take us to our limits, and people's grief doesn't resolve itself on my timeline, right? When I'm ready to disengage, right? But there are those times when I run out and I have nothing more to give, and it's when I need somebody else to step in and to be the compassionate one, so I can take that necessary step back. And so anyways, I guess, for people who are interested in this kind of work, whether it's professionally or whether it's just taking care of our neighbors, taking care of our families, taking care of the people we home and visit teach, right? That we can trust that it doesn't all have to be on any one person. Sometimes it does, but when we can reach out to the community, let's do that.
Wonderful. Both on the reaching out part and just recognizing your own needs to be met at times too. And find those energies from either other people or time alone and, breaks.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Nathan, what would you end with?
I would say I'm really grateful for a forum in which this topic and others like them can be discussed. Too often I come across people who are struggling, and they have the perception that they're struggling alone. And it's a forum like this that not only equips people who would like to do more, which I think is beautiful, but I'm guessing that there are many times people who, in their research or searching or yearning for a validating voice, come across this podcast or others, like them, that let them know that the needs that they have or the questions that are there they're not the only ones answering them. They're not the only ones looking, and it's too often my experience, and it's not merely because I'm in a backwoods place in Oklahoma, that I come across people who feel alone in their suffering or in their search or in their need. And so we've taken an awful lot of time tonight to discuss this topic, and I'm grateful for the forum. I'm grateful for the camaraderie we've experienced. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's an amazing place to sit here where I'm sitting. I don't know how it happened, but I appreciate all the strengthening that comments like that give for creating this space, as well as the emails and things and that come. So you are not alone. If nothing else, thank you for that message. No one is alone, and thank goodness for the internet and things like this. But I don't know if I've just been lucky. I just have to think that the more that you risk in terms of who called it the three best words are not "I love you," but I don't know.
Yeah, my father said that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the more you risk that kind of attitude in front of other people in your ward and things in places where everyone's expected to have answers, and we tend to be not comfortable with chaos or not having things all neat and tidy and in their spot. I tell you, that's the secret to finding new friends and new connections is to do those I don't knows. So anyway, that's an encouragement for everybody out there, I hope. Listeners, please, if you like this panel of these three amazing, experienced, deeply spiritual guys, super articulate, let's please propose other topics that you'd like. Maybe every 2.5-3 months we'll have the chaplains on for a little series. So the chaplains on grace, spiritual transformation, Mormonism in dialogue with other faiths, prayer, anything that strikes you as something you'd love this panel to get back together on. I'd love to make it a quarterly feature or something here on Mormon Matters.
That's manageable.
Thank you guys for being willing. You told me in advance you were, and so we're putting you on the spot here that we're committing you to it as we go. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it's as if Mormon Matters and the community around it through the through the blog and everything is one of Hauwass's communities of care. As people, as Nathan said, recognize that they're not alone, that other people have the same struggles or have the same thoughts. And so there you go.
I appreciate that. Good night. Thanks
again. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.